Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Coach Conversations, sponsored by the Phoenix Chapter of the International Coach Federation. My name is Catherine Halpin, and I am your host today, and I am very pleased and honored to introduce our guest. We have an extraordinarily special guest today on our show, Dr. Marcia Reynolds. Marcia's based here in Scottsdale, Arizona, like me in Phoenix. Dr. Reynolds amuses, inspires, and fascinates her audiences as she translates the latest discoveries of how the brain works into workable strategies for dealing with life's challenges. We all have those, don't we? In addition to speaking and training around the world, Dr. Reynolds coaches both individuals and executive teams. Her clients come from technical, pharmaceutical, financial, shipping, and banking corporations in both governmental and quasi-governmental organizations. Prior to starting her own business, Marcia's greatest success story came as a result of designing the programs for a semiconductor manufacturing company facing bankruptcy. Working with the executive staff, she designed the organizational change program that helped the company become the number one stock market success in the United States when they went public in 1993, just the other day. Marcia's doctoral degree is in organizational psychology. She has published two books that we're going to talk a lot about, Outsmart Your Brain and Wonder Woman, How High-Achieving Women Find Contentment and Direction. Excerpts from her books have appeared in many places, including Harvard Communications newsletters, U.S. Business Review, Forbes.com, CNN.com, Psychology Today, and the New York Times, and she's appeared on the ABC World News. Marcia is also a pioneer in the coaching profession and was the fifth president of the International Coach Federation, and that's the global organization, not our Phoenix chapter that sponsors this show today. She was one of the first 25 people in the world to earn the designation of Master Certified Coach, MCC, and today, almost 15 years later, there are only 621 people in the whole world that hold that designation. It's such a highly esteemed certification. She's also a certified speaking professional through the National Speakers Association. And while you're listening to our interview today, if you'd like to go on Marcia's website to get more information, it's http://outsmartyourbrain.com. One word, outsmartyourbrain.com. So welcome, Marcia. We're so happy that you could join us today.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Yes, we are very happy to have you, too. I'm joined by Dr. Anna Melikan, who's our producer for this show. Anna will be piping in periodically. If you're listening and you'd like to call in and speak with Marcia, our number is 424-243-9638. Feel free to dial in, and I know Marcia will be happy to take your call, 424-243-9638. As I indicated in the introduction, Marcia and I have a long, rich, very rich history together. We both met before either of us were coaches. We met in the early 1990s when we were both on a nonprofit startup trying to form a resource center for prostitutes coming out of the jail in downtown Phoenix. And that's where I first met you, Marcia. And we've had a strong connection ever since. But before we talk about us, let's talk about your background. Where did you grow up, and what part of the world was that? Were you, I always like to know if people were the only child, were they the oldest child, that sort of thing. So tell us about your family.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I do travel. I'm out of the country almost every month. I've been traveling for work since the mid '80s. But I was born here where I still live. I've never lived anywhere else. I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and I still live here. I move every few years, but it's just kind of right around the same vicinity. I move a couple miles here, a couple miles there. So I get to see the world, but it's very hard for me to find a place, especially weather-wise, that's even better than Phoenix. But it was a very small town back in the years when I was born. So there was not a lot of us natives back then. So I got to see, the entire growth which was interesting. And I'm I have two brothers and a sister, so I'm a middle. I'm in the middle.
Oh, you're the middle child.
I'm in the middle. My parents actually met here. They both came from different cities and came out, you know, because there's a lot of opportunity in the 40s in this brand new little town called Phoenix, and they met here. And so there was a child, though, in between my sister and I that had died, so it's almost like I was a firstborn again. I'm a... That was weird.
Yeah, but they were most excited about your arrival.
It was interesting. I mean, I can go into a lot of, you know, the impact of that on me, and my whole obsessiveness with being great in something, because I had to be.
Right.
So yeah.
Right. Well. Would you be willing to share with our listeners a little bit of your story about what brought you to that nonprofit startup, why you were motivated to help work with women who are in jail?
Sure.
Good. Thank you.
You know, it actually comes out of that. It's, you know, it's one thing to tell your child, you know, you can do anything, you're really good. You're really great. But when you add on to that, and you're better than other people, I think, you know, my parents were doing their best, especially with me being a girl, you know, that knowing it'd be tough to get out there and fight the fight. But it's always a lot of pressure on a kid to be the best, and I was really good at a lot of things. But I was smart, but there was always somebody one step ahead of me. You know, I was cute, but there was always one girl just a little cuter.
Right.
I was good at sports, but, you know, I never got over about 4'11", and a lot of those girl sports required a little bit longer legs than me. So it was, I did well in terms of being popular in school, but when I got into high school, the game changed. And I still needed to try to maintain being popular and being the best at something. And what that did, and remember, this was like late 60s, early 70s, you know, what kids were doing at that time, you know, little sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So I decided I'd be the best. Yeah, I'd be the best drug user. And you know what? I did really well.
Uh-huh.
I kept my popularity, and, you know, I found something I was good at. And amazingly enough, and what saved me was that I still, no matter how crazy and wild I got, I still had... You know, the light side of what they did, it was still embedded in me to do well, to get good grades. So even though it may have pushed me over the edge, I still had those values that really, when I pulled my life back around, I still had the values of going to school, you know, doing well and excelling at whatever I chose. But, you know, I did get involved in drugs, and once you go down that path, you know, it's very hard to get back out. And I went all the way over the edge and ended up in jail when I was 19. And had a number of things that happened, actually, that being in jail wasn't great. But the women, you know, no matter what path you run in life, there's you know, you'll find good people everywhere, even if they've really struggled with their lives and they've gone down difficult paths. And the women in jail really gave me a sense of who I was and what's really important and what I was capable of achieving that maybe they could never do in their lives. And it helped me strengthen my inner, both my confidence and my resolve, that I was going to, you know, make a difference when I got out. And there were a lot of things I tried to do, you know, like the thing we met, where to try to help women who are in those difficult situations to try to have a life, because the system doesn't really do much for them. It's really got to be the, you know, the nonprofit groups that come together to help. And, you know, those are critical. But, you know, that was also an interesting path. I thought that's the way I'd go, but I really struggled finding work that way. And then I got into, immediately when I got into the corporate world, I landed in a corporate training department actually doing video, running the, I was the audio visual coordinator. My first
message, I love this story.
Yeah, my first message was broadcasting, but I ended up in the training department and my boss decided to go get her doctorate and dump the whole thing in my lap. And that's how I ended up on this path. It was, my first assignment was management training, and I quickly understood that everything that I had learned on that strange path I went down was going to help me in navigating corporate life and trying to bring some humanity and values to what is leadership and corporate culture. And many times I had to be the real warrior, in those companies, especially coming into the middle late 80s and 90s. But I've been able to also see the evolution of what is leadership over the years. So it wasn't necessarily going to be my path, to help women in jail, but I still have, do what I can and go to jails and talk to them and tell that story. Because there's always, even though I may be speaking to management women when I tell the story, there's always somebody in the audience whose daughter's struggling or son or spouse. And, maybe themselves. So I can, and I understand addiction, whether it's, addicted to your work addicted to a substance. In fact, I was talking to a reporter this morning from Elle Magazine, and she says, how do you identify an addiction to work? How do you know the difference between being really passionate and being addicted? And I'm like, wow. Fine line. Right. And I said, I think you really have to look at what's the impact on your health and your relationships, and if you're sacrificing everything in your life like an addict would, and you can't stop, then I would say that's over the line.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's an excellent description, Marcia. As a recovering workaholic, I'm always looking for those distinctions. So thank you for sharing that. That makes me feel really great because there was a time in my life that I did sacrifice my relationships and my health for my work, but today I don't. And so that's great. And I just loved hearing that story one more time. And I appreciate you sharing it. My belief is that we all have a story. We just have to be willing to share our stories. And you're one of the first people that I met as an adult who had a compelling story and just shared it freely and authentically at any opportunity. And I'm just so grateful to you for being that role model for all of us.
Well, Catherine, one of the things I found is that we can, there's our stories, if we're learning and we're helping people learn from our stories, then they are great to relive. When we get stuck in our stories, then that's the problem. And we also have to have a story that we're creating. So I also know, the story that I want to live, as well as, what was the value of my past. And I think that both of those are really important to have.
Beautifully stated. Beautifully stated. You've answered this question, but what were those pivotal experiences that led you from training into coaching? Because I know you were not just a trainer, but you started as a trainer, you started as an audiovisual person, and then you moved quickly into training, and then you moved into organizational effectiveness and consulting at the C level in that company that you helped turn around. So what then led successes?
Though, of course, we always think we're doing coaching until we know what coaching really is.
Right.
So even though I in my last position, I was in a place to where I could counsel and work with, the senior team, and I had a lot of fulfillment in doing that. And when people came to me individually, enough that when I read an article about coaching, I said, "Oh, I want to do this. I really like this." And it was enough to get me to intrigue me about it and to to follow that path and to even sign up for Coach U, you know, right? You and I were there at the same time.
Right.
The one of two coaching schools in existence at the time.
Right.
And then, you know, when I really learned what coaching was, then I could say, well, I really wasn't quite coaching back then. Yeah. But it
right.
was the one-on-one and the being able to work with someone over time. And I did even have one particular success story was when I had joined the company I was paired up with. At the time, he was the manager of quality. And him and I, you know, we clicked and yet we fought. And, you know, there were so many things that, I mean, because he wanted to make a lot of changes too. We saw things differently, but then we learned from each other. And he went from manager to director to vice president to senior vice president in the 5 years I was there.
I love that. Yeah. With your
Yeah, and I thought, okay, and in fact, he was like one of my first clients because when I resigned, he's like, well, who am I going to talk to? And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to be here anymore. You're going to need to, you know, find someone and all. And he says, but I'll pay you. And I said, oh, okay, well.
Right.
Yay, here's my contact.
Right. We were all looking for those paying clients in those early days. I love that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Oh, that's such a great story.
Yeah.
Now, let's go back.
Well, and it was coaching.
Oh, go ahead.
I just want to say that it was the two things. It was coaching and public speaking. That I wanted, that I knew I wanted to take on in addition to the training. And I still do all three, and I like the balance. I like the balance. You know, when one goes down, the other goes up. It balances me economically as well as just, you know, who I am.
Right,
it could
right, right. Gives you that multiple streams of income, but mm-hmm. also gives you different ways to get energy.
Yeah.
And, right.
Right.
From your audiences. I've seen you present many, many times, and I know that. Right. Well, let's take a step back to your Coach U Day. What was the magazine article that you read that told you,
it
heard about
it? It was famous Susan Corbett at the time.
Susan Corbett Klein.
Yeah, I think so many of us read that article.
Yes, that's the one that brought me to Coach U, too. Right.
Isn't that funny?
It's so funny. The National Association of Female Executives magazine. I don't know if they're still in existence, but
but they're small. Yeah, they're not like they used to be.
But it was a great article on career coaching. But even though I didn't know anything about career coaching, I still call the number, and Thomas answered the phone. And I told him later of that story, and I said, you got right back with me like in 20 minutes. And he said, oh, I would have picked up right away, but I was probably sending somebody a fax. He was pretty much a one-man show, I think.
Yeah, right. And that was, back in the days when the fax line was the same line.
Right. Isn't that great? Oh, I love that. I did not realize that it was that same article. But we have so many points of contact here. Well, what would you say is your philosophy of coaching? And I'm anxious to get to your book. I love your Wonder Woman book. I love it, and I think we all females can relate to that sense of always looking for more contentment. But I really want to hear about your oldest book, Outsmart Your Brain, and how that interacts with your philosophy of coaching.
Yeah, and you know, that book I was in it's March. I'm in O Magazine this month.
Congratulations.
Thanks. A nice quote and a mention of that book. And so it's right now temporarily out of stock on Amazon.
That's a good
which
thing.
Which is good news, but I've already shipped them another batch. But, you know, what I love about Outsmart Your Brain is that the stuff doesn't get old. You know, it's about some really important things we should all know about what our brain is doing to us, that I think is really critical to coaching. And although that we're finding new things about the brain all the time, there's just some things that are standard, but yet not old information, because they weren't able to scan the brain and really understand how we process information until the mid-90s. So all the stuff that we understand about the brain now is really, you know, only about a decade old. But it comes in conflict with some of the things that have been popular, especially in this past decade, with the whole self-talk, change your thoughts, you change your behavior, which all that's nice, but it leaves out the element of emotion. And if you leave out the element of emotion, then you're missing the point. And especially, you know, what we were talking about before, when you get into coaching, if you don't get underneath the words, you know, and it's not just hearing the emotion, but really understanding what's driving the emotion, what's at the source. And if you can help a client understand that, what's next for them, the options that they need to take, or even what they know they need to do, becomes crystal clear.
Right.
And that's what we talk about, right, with active listening, with direct communications, powerful questions, and creating awareness. All of that comes from getting beneath the surface, not just the words or what the person says they're thinking. You know, and so if you really want to master those competencies, you know, you need to have a little bit of awareness of what's going on in the brain underneath the surface.
Right.
And that's what excited me when I first did the research and wrote the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk in practical terms. So someone like me who is a recovering adrenaline addict, for instance, I can, you know, I tell people I'm just one drink away from getting overstimulated, overexcited, over enthusiastic. When the emotion is enthusiasm, what are some practices that I might do to help slow down that brain and channel that energy appropriately? Because in the past, so just so you know, I think you know this, but in the past, when I had less awareness about myself, like when I was a CPA, I couldn't tell an idea from a good idea. And today I'm still very much for that because I have so much enthusiasm.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, there is the practice. There's two things. I mean, there's one to really look at, you know, what's driving the overenthusiasm, the, you know, the going over the edge, you know, there's that piece, but there's also the piece of what you just asked for is how can I recognize that? How can I be aware, you know, stop and take that breath, which is one of the best things to do, to stop that adrenaline flow and step back and take a look and say, what is it I truly need to do right now? What is the truth here about what's going on? Is there anything else that I need to know? And what is it I'm not seeing?
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent questions.
You know, because we so quickly, like you say, we do, you know, just jump into assuming whether it's a good thing or not so good. You know,
right.
I was coaching this one executive team, and their director was leaving, and he asked me to coach them, and I went in, and they all ran around the table and telling me all the things they're going to do now that this terrible thing was happening. You know, one guy, I've been here forever. It was a quasi-governmental place. So, you know, they'd all been there forever, you know. And he's like, I'm going to retire. And another one is, I'm going to take my team, and we're just going to, like, huddle up and do this. And, I mean, it was all just this, you know, they had jumped into what they were going to do next. And I said, okay, that's great. I hear what you are afraid could happen. Now tell me what you know to be true in this moment. Just everything that you know to be true and only true. And the only truth really in that moment was the director is leaving. Right?
Wow. I love
and
that.
And it's like, okay, now that you know that that's the truth, nothing else is true here.
Right.
What can we do with that truth? And what they came up with was, well, I guess we need to plan, do a succession plan that's where we can be strong enough to weather any person that they appoint as our leader.
I love that.
Yeah, and thanks. And the thing was is that they had to like vent and you know go through whatever stuff they need to go through, but then to stop and really say, okay, that's great, and all, you know, we have to separate out what is speculation from what you know to be true, and then we can go with the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say even in your situation, you still need to step back and separate out, you know, what's all the stuff that you're dreaming up in your head.
Mm-hmm. Right.
From what's
right.
real in this moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. What's the truth? What are the I call it the facts. What are the facts?
Mm-hmm.
Get to the facts. That's so great. And then the breathing. I've the last 35 years really become a huge fan of the power of breathing. I know for myself just that I try to do Dr. Andrew Weil's 4-7-8 breathing exercise at least a dozen times a day because
and what is that?
Well, I might have learned this from Anna. Did I learn this from you, Anna?
It's one of my favorite breathing exercises of Dr. Weil. It's based in yoga breathing, and it's really a way of resetting our nervous system to calm down.
Mm-hmm.
And a very important thing that anybody can do now, whenever they start the breathing, start with exhalation first. Exhale as much as you can, because that really allows us to breathe in deeply afterwards. It's like emptying the cup first. And that exercise starts exactly with that restarting.
I love that. And it's 4-7-8. It's you. First you breathe out. You exhale like you're blowing up a balloon. That's when I
mm-hmm.
heard Anna present that. That's what she said. And then you breathe in to a count of four.
Hold for seven. And release by the mouth by eight.
How fabulous.
Four in, all for seven, and release four. And for only four cycles, that is very important.
I never heard that.
I can see, Catherine. I can see.
How
otherwise, you can hyperventilate, and it's not good.
Yeah, and I always tell people that, too. Yeah, don't get to hyperventilation. You need to come back to normal breathing.
Right.
And then breathe as if you were with an old friend.
Yeah, so you were comfortable.
Yeah.
And
right, that's what I always added. You know, I heard the other day, I was listening to somebody talking about the brain, and they were just, it's not just to calm you down, to stop that adrenaline flow, but when you get into that stage, just the activity in the brain also then increases. You have full use of the brain. Because when you're running on adrenaline, you're actually shutting down a lot of systems in your brain.
Right.
Even though you think that you're operating, you know, at your best of your ability, you're
right.
not. You know,
right.
Because the brain is still setting you up to fight or flight, because that's what adrenaline does. So, you know, you've got all this physical energy going on, but not mental energy.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a great exercise then to, you know, put yourself in a state where you can then be creative and, come up with what it is you want to do to create this thing you're excited about.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it's so funny that y'all bring up about the hyperventilating, because I was at a conference in Acapulco in the year 2000. It was a spirituality and business conference that no longer exists, put on by a group out of Santa Fe. I went a couple of times, and this was our first time, and it was in Acapulco, and I was on the beach with somebody wearing a turban and a whole group of people doing meditation and breathing, and I did hyperventilate. I needed much closer supervision than they provided. And that whole day was just a terrible, terrible day for me because I did not know that I had hyperventilated. All I knew was that I was ready to chew nails. I was so frazzled and frenetic. So, yes, thank you, Marcia and Anna, for clarifying. But, you know, it's important to do the breathing, but then bring yourself back and be in that relaxed state as if you're with an old friend. I love that. Well, I want to talk about your Wonder Woman book, because that's your newest book, and I know Outsmart Your Brain really feeds your whole coaching philosophy, but that's an important book, too, because the three of us, we're all women, and I think there are so many women that do share similar characteristics, and you've hit on all those in your book. So tell us about that book, Marcia.
Sure. And, you know, what's really interesting, too, is that I've had, when I teach workshops on the principles in Wonder Woman, there's always guys that say, well, we're the same, too. But I'm finding the inner generation of men is mapping a lot to the motivations of, you know, that had shifted from women earlier. And I've had a lot, I've had men say, thank you, because now I really understand, you know, my daughter, my wife, my colleague a lot better.
Yeah.
So, it's like, yeah, all men ought to read this. Well, because I find one of the biggest things with my clients, my female clients, is that they are misunderstood. Their passion is often misunderstood for anger and insensitivity. Their motivations for working hard are misunderstood because it's not about titles and money. It's about creating something important. It's about new challenge, about motion and meaning is what I call it. We have to have motion and meaning in our lives, which is even more important than titles and money, unless the titles and money can give us the motion and meaning. And so it comes from my doctoral research, because what I was looking at what at that time, which was about 2005, what was out there in terms of resources for women, for smart, strong, goal-driven women, was very little. And I heard this guy talking about women in the workplace, and he was talking, it's like my mother, you know,
wow.
In terms of, you know, they only care about their family until much later in their lives when the family's grown. I'm like, oh, no, not the women I coach. Yeah, and all the books were on acted as if all women were the same, and we were all weak and couldn't speak up for ourselves. And I'm like, no, my clients speak up for themselves maybe too often.
Right.
And like things, articles about, you know, the trouble saying no, and my clients had trouble saying no, but it wasn't because they were worried people wouldn't like them. They just thought they were the only ones that could do the work well. They did everything.
Right.
And so what I found when I started doing the research was that, you know, it's true. There is a real shift in how girls are raised, and it started in big numbers with girls being brought up in the 60s and the 70s. And that means that those hitting management, you know, by the late 80s and the 90s and now, were different. And yet, it's just starting to be articulated in the last few years of who we are, what we need, what drives us. But the main thing was, you know, really finding this restlessness, that there's always something more out there, and the work is never good enough, we're never good enough, the people around us are never good enough. You know?
Right.
And it's just almost this incessant push, you know, to keep wanting more. And like this woman from Elle Magazine, the reporter I was talking to this morning, she's 28, and she said, well, my friends, we're all working really, really hard because we know in 10 years we may want to slow down because we'll have families. And I said, really? Do you really think you're going to slow down even when you have those babies? I said, maybe for a moment. But this thing you're feeling now, it's not going to go away just when you hold that baby. You know, I mean, after, you know, a few months, I mean, a number of the women in my research that had babies said, you know, I think my children, I would drive them crazy if I stayed home.
And
what they did was they found, you know, men who, or partners who had home-based businesses.
I love that.
So
a balance.
You know, yeah, so, you know, they're redefining relationship as well. So I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten from women all over the world that just said, thank you. I thought I was weird and something was wrong with me. And when I read the first chapter of your book, I realized that I'm not weird. There's a lot of women like me, and I'm not alone.
Right.
And even if I can't fix them, at least the awareness that, you know, of why this is going on in their lives was so huge. And then the rest of the book really does give a lot of exercises. I do a lot of work with the archetypes and identifying our contribution beyond our skills and knowledge, because we kind of lose our sense of self. Really looking for a sense of passion to anchor yourself. And, you know, there's a lot of exercises, good coaching exercises and questions in the book. And so many of my clients are these, you know, again, and I say smart, strong, goal-driven, because I found that high achieving was misleading. That a lot of women said to me, I really am what you talk about in the book, but I wouldn't call myself high achieving, because they didn't see themselves as a CEO. And I said, you know, high achiever could also be the woman who wants to be the best cupcake maker and Girl Scout leader.
Right.
You know,
right,
and
exactly.
Chose to do so.
Right. It doesn't have to be the CEO.
Right, right. And so, you know, I would, if the book wasn't published by someone else, I probably would have changed the subtitle. But so it's you know, in all walks. There was this one woman that I met who had been a celebrated marine biologist, and then said, okay, been there, done that. Went up to Stanford, got an MBA, worked for a company, and then, you know, decided, you know, wasn't enough, had to move on. Worked for an international consultancy firm. And when I met her, she was here in Phoenix. She was on the board of the opera and the theater, so she wasn't doing nothing. But she was taking some time with her daughter, and she said, you know, all my life I was taught to raise my hand, and I'm just taking a moment just to ask myself, what am I raising my hand for? And that's the type of thing, yeah, that I think it's really important that, you know, we do for our clients, that they understand, you know, what is going on, what's driving them, what's the motivation, what they really, what's truly important for them next.
Right, so they can choose rather than just be on that
instead of just leaving.
Right.
You know, it's like, whether it's been there, done that, or these people aren't giving me enough recognition, it's still emotionally driven, not being pulled by our passion and vision.
Right. Can you say a little bit more about that?
When we make decisions on emotion, you know, like my boss is a jerk, this company doesn't care, I'm not getting enough challenges, I'm bored. That's all emotion, and that's not so, you know, a lot of my clients that come to me, it's like they in their head, they're like, I'm done already.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, could we just work on what it is you really want for yourself in the long run? And it doesn't have to be a specific goal, but just what it is you want to create. Because you might find that there's still some things you can learn in this place before you leave.
Right.
And you will better define what it is you want to do. And I had one client where, you know, she was, like, ready to go. You know, I talked her into, you know, we did a lot of work on what she wanted to create. And she spent a lot of time talking to the leaders that didn't feel she was ready for a higher level leadership, but really trying to find out what they felt she needed. And in a non-defensive place, you know, mm-hmm. she had these conversations. So we could really look at what she wanted to learn and create. And at the end of 6 months, she still decided to leave. But she was able to move into the type of position that she had created, you know, this is really what I want to do and what the type of leader I want to be. And so she was able to find that type of position. She didn't just go take something else. And then it was a quasi-governmental position, and she was recognized by the governor of her state, and she's now the head of health and human resources for her state.
Oh, I love that.
In fact, she picked me up in her private car, picked me up at the airport
when I
visited her last.
I love
you know,
that.
Because, again, she was just so angry because they weren't going to promote her, and her boss was just crazy. You know, he's scared of her and wasn't going to really talk to her. And so we really work through, and I do have permission to tell her story. You know, we've talked about it a lot. And but I wouldn't say who she is or where she is or anything like that.
Sure.
But, but you know, a lot of it was really, really talking to the people she was angry with and finding out, you know, trying to discern what was real and what was not real and what could be helpful to her.
Mm-hmm.
That was really important, you know, as well as trying.
I was going to call it part of the healing process, you know, help her be able
to...
Yes,
you're right.
Power. Right.
You're right. You're right, very much. Yeah. You know, and again, to be a little bit more objective with it instead of just emotional in the decision.
Right.
And, you know, we're all master rationalizers, so she had full, you know, fully cooked rationalizations.
Oh, worse. It wasn't her fault. Her boss was an idiot. Dog ate her homework.
Right. Well, that may be true, and it's not necessarily the best reasons to, you know, to take a new move in your career. So, yeah.
What a great...
But again, that's why we have to really, really, really listen underneath and not just go with what, you know, I mean, there is a difference between the client's, quote, agenda and, you know, what they're saying in the moment that they want to do. You know, if the agenda is really to move forward into a better place,
right.
There still might be that you don't sit there and just try to and go with that and say, okay, so what's possible? What have you looked at? What have you tried? You know, it's like, well, no, wait, let's step back. You know, let's look at what's the motivation for leaving? What is it that you're missing? What are you not getting? What do you want to create? You know, what is it you need to live that story? I mean, those are the things we really need to go into with our clients to help them really make the best choices.
Yes.
And
yes.
Even if it makes them angry, right?
Right. Well, we have to go there. Well, that's what makes you a master coach. So talk a little bit about your commitment to the International Coach Federation. I know it is huge, and one of the goals of our Blog Talk Radio show, Coach Conversations, is to promote the concept of being an ICF-certified coach. So tell us, Marcia, what motivated you in the beginning and what motivates you today, almost 20 years later?
Yeah. Well, you know, back when, when we were just kind of starting the whole ICF, I think, though, that there was this sense of that this is critical. If this profession is going to survive in a world where all these people are calling themselves coach, when, like me, I didn't even know I wasn't really coaching until I went to coaching school, that there needed to be a strong professional association that stood, you know, for what coaching really is and the difference we can make in this world. And to me, that's still why you join the ICF, you know, not what it's going to do for you and your business in the sense of personally, but on a bigger scale, it is going to be, it's important for your business because there has to be, you know, a strong definition and distinction of coaching. And really good coaches out there so people, you know, get a taste of what coaching is. And to this day, I still am committed that to, you know, the ICF standing for, you know, the competencies, the ethics, and the definition of coaching. And you know, it stirs my heart so much when they show all the countries, you know, on the map of the countries at the conference. And you know, last year, was it?
In Las Vegas.
Was it Vegas or the year before? Yeah, I think it was last year. The guy from Bulgaria won a chapter award.
Yes, yeah.
And I have to tell you, and he came to me and he said, I was just saying, you know, this is really cool because his story was so cool about how, you know, nobody knew coaching and so many times they wanted to give up because, they, you know, and why are we doing this and putting our heart and our soul and our money into it. And afterwards he said to me, he said, you know, a couple years ago at the 10th year anniversary when all the past presidents, we got our 3 to 5 minutes to tell a story right on the stage. And I talked about how we used to have the huggers.
Right.
I love the huggers. And
right.
It was, you know, more intimate.
Right.
But, you know, but there was a lot of crazy things, Catherine, as you and I know, that
right.
went on that, you know, the ICF almost, you know, tanked how many
right.
times. You know, you
right.
know, you and I could sit around and swap stories for hours.
Right.
And how we held the ICF together with duct
right.
tape.
That's right.
You know, and
we
yet,
sure
you know,
did.
Because we knew how important it was. And he said to me, he goes, you know, I saw you speak and tell that story. And he says, every time that we would start to lose faith, I watched that tape and listened to you, and you just gave me the strength to go on.
Oh, my gosh, that gives me goosebumps, Marcia.
I know, and I'm like, oh, my, me too. It just made me cry. I'm like, really? Oh, my God, thank you.
Oh,
and then it just reinvigorates me as to why I'm still committed and show up, you know, for the ICF and stand for the competencies and the ethics and what we are trying to do in the world. And I want people to join for that reason, you know,
right.
not because they'll be on the ICF referral list. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I was willing to join you on the board back in 1998 when I joined the board, you were already on the board, and I was willing to join it was because I knew then that our professional association was that valuable. But
I think I begged you. Please, Catherine.
But I wanted it to be valuable in the decades to come, and today when we're in 108 countries and with
right.
almost 20,000 professional
yeah.
members. Yeah, it's so
yeah.
exciting. Well,
yeah.
Let's talk about the PRISM Awards. You know, given that you were a president, you were the fifth president, I just don't remember when the PRISM Awards started, but do you recall, was that on your watch or a little bit later?
No, that was a couple years after. I don't even think it was Bobette. I think it was after her, so it was about 3 years after me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But what I love to tell people about the PRISM Award, and for our listeners, let me just say what it is. It's an award that goes to a company or an organization or governmental entity that has brought in ICF-certified coaches to work with them and their teams, their leadership teams, their management teams, and they apply for this prestigious award, and it is given out at our annual conference, which last year was in Las Vegas. This year it's going to be in London, England, because it is, after all, an international conference. And for the first time, the Phoenix chapter, which is our sponsor of this radio show, the Phoenix chapter of the ICF is going to have their own regional PRISM Award,
yeah,
and they're
I love
taking
that.
Applications now. Isn't that exciting?
Mm-hmm.
So have you been on that committee at all or to help select those winners? I know NASA's been a winner. I know Ernst & Young has been a winner.
Yeah. I've not. I've just been a witness.
The one thing that you haven't done for the ICF.
Right, but you know, it's really great when, you know, these companies just totally embrace coaching it. You know, but truly, honestly, whatever companies I've worked for around the world, it's like once they get a taste of the power of coaching, as you know, it's like, oh my. And
right.
a lot of them will even then decide to bring it in and get their internal people you know, educated in coaching, but they know it, and it's so great when these companies then stand for coaching and say, this is what, you know, not just it will help us get great results, but help people, you know,
right.
feel really dedicated to their companies. And so I love the PRISM Award. I think it's really great.
Well, if our listeners are interested in learning more about the Phoenix Chapter's PRISM Award, you can go to www.icfphoenix, all spelled out, phoenix.com, and click on the PRISM Award, Phoenix. It's going to be presented on June 28th, and we're very pleased to announce that Stephen Covey's son, Stephen M.R. Covey, the author of the best-selling book The Speed of Trust, will be our keynote speaker for that event on June 28th.
I know, that's so exciting.
Isn't that exciting that we could have that kind of speaker? So we're all hustling to get companies nominated and to fill those seats to hear him, because it's a wonderful opportunity. And not only are they going to hear him at lunch, but certain attendees will get a chance to stay for the afternoon and have a very intimate dialogue with Stephen M.R. Covey. That portion of the program will be limited to only 80 people.
That'll be great.
Yeah,
I mean, trust is huge.
Right. Oh, my gosh. For those of us who work in corporate environments, we know it's huge. Well, tell us a little bit, Marcia, about what your ideal client is. And people can get to you through www.outsmartyourbrain.com. But just tell us a little bit about who should be looking for you out there to connect for your professional services, whether it's speaking, whether it's training, whether it's coaching.
As far as coaching goes, it's like most of my clients are, when I say executive women, it's women from a director level up in companies. I do some mentor coaching, I think I've got a niche in the last couple of years of people who have failed their certification exams and then come to me. And I've got a good track record of them passing.
I love that. I love that.
I've heard some pretty poor exams. You know, I'm still an assessor for the ICF and for COCHU, and so I can fairly quickly hear what they're doing wrong.
Right.
And I'm sad they didn't get, good mentoring in the first place, because there's so many good mentor coaches out there.
Right.
And I always recommend that people get some mentoring from someone that went through a different school than they went through, because especially if you're going to go for your MCC, because if we hear the school in you, that's a problem. That means you need to broaden out beyond your school. I mean, it's great. There's great schools there. And then I've gone through, after Coach U, I went through the basic foundation courses at CTI, Adler, and I've done courses, done some work with Jeffrey Auerbach at the executive coaching and Newfield. I mean, it's like I want to know what they're all doing and their different take on coaching. I think that's really critical, and it's important. As well as, when I get my own coaches, I've had different coaches from different backgrounds, and it's good to have that. So, So I do a little bit of mentor coaching, not a lot, because I'm doing a lot of training with, my leadership programs. There's always a good coaching element in it, and I've just found how more powerful my training is now that I add both coaching and storytelling.
More about that. I love the storytelling.
Well, we learned that from public speaking, how powerful storytelling is, and so I pulled it into the classroom. Of course, I don't want to make it all about me, and so, I'm careful about the stories, and it's usually after they've gone through the experience, the learning experience, and then I'll just, icing on the cake, top it off with a story. Or if the story will really give them clarity on how to apply what they've learned, or the mistakes that I've made.
Right.
Again, like a speech, it's carefully designed into the training, but just makes them remember.
Yeah.
And gives them the courage and the hope to go out and do what they did in the classroom.
Right. I say they won't remember our PowerPoints, but they will remember our stories.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Right. That just speaks again to your high degree of authenticity, that you're so generous with your stories, Marcia. I so appreciate that.
Thank you. And, you know, I've also gotten away from doing the introductions and icebreakers and all of that. I start with a powerful question. I engage them right away. Yeah, and because then they immediately put away their phones and they're not thinking, you know, I could have worked for another hour. You know, I get them into the conversation right away with a good, strong coaching question. So I'm teaching leadership around the world. And a lot of that, you know, with follow-up coaching as a part of the contract, you know, and then maybe some refresher training. And so a lot of my work is projects with, you know, with training and coaching.
With the different components. That's so great.
Well, I know, because then you get to use all of it.
Well, we heard Randy Pennington at the National Speakers Association Arizona chapter last Saturday, and that's what he said, that we have to have a bubble, and in the in that bubble is what we do, and then we, the spokes from the bubble are the speaking, the coaching, the writing, the training, the blogs, the social media, the videos, the YouTube. So you're doing that. You're a role model for us, and frankly have been all along, so we... Once again, I have to thank you for being such a great role model for us. Well, I want to give your website one more time. Outsmartyourbrain.com is Dr. Marcia Reynolds' website. If you'd like to get more information about her, get her contact information. And her two books are Wander Woman, for those high-performing women, and Outsmart Your Brain, which is really gives you the basis for what we've heard today about her coaching approach and getting to those emotions and getting to the root, getting underneath the surface issues. And I can't thank you enough, Marcia, for your generosity today. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you want to take a moment to share with our listeners?
You know, I think one of the things that I've always learned about coaching or realized is that you're never going to be a perfect coach. And every year I find I get better at my coaching, and then I wonder, like, wow, I was really bad.
I love that.
And I have to stay on top of it because I still, you know, catch myself being the guru and having the answers. We're always going to fall into those pitfalls, and there is no perfection. We're always growing and learning and getting better. And I just want all coaches to know that as they keep growing and learning, and that they will always grow and learn and get better since there's no perfection.
Right. Well, what I like to say is that, you know, everything evolves as it should. So you're not, it's not that you were a terrible coach last year, but you have evolved. Today, and your thinking is different. Your thinking is different. Yeah. I said to a client earlier this week that I was trying to sell. I'm new to the game of training. I've always just done the coaching and facilitation, and just in the last few years I've added the training, and I'm trying to sell a fairly large-scale training engagement to a big client of mine. And I said to her, even if I came in for half a day with, you know, with three or four teams, so we did a couple of days a month, on site in these half-day training sessions, I said, even if I presented the same topic every month to every team, their experiences would be new. Their thinking would be different than it had been the month before, and so the material would be rich again and valuable for them. So I totally do not believe that you are a bad coach last year, but I do appreciate that you're always growing in development. It's called what we call walking our talk as coaches.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Dr. Anna Melikan, for being our producer and getting us all here today. Thank you to Dr. Marcia Reynolds for being so generous and sharing all of her stories. And for our listeners, you'll be able to, of course, listen in later and hear this over and over and share it with your friends. Our next show is Friday, April the 20th. We're going to have as our guest Connie Kadansky. And Connie's a longtime Phoenix coach and consultant and has an amazing story to tell also. So we look forward to being back together on Friday, April the 20th. Thanks, Marcia. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you.
Of course. Bye.
Bye.